Truth Hour, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for July the 8th, 2018. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, taking you all the way from the fifth floor of City Hall and the second floor of the State House in Springfield out to the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, we crossed past the 4th of July holiday. Hope you all had a great celebration. It was great to sit down with friends and family, eat some great food, and stay hydrated. And thank goodness, oh, that holiday humidity went away. Babe, I tell you, that was something else.
It went underway, you might say, with a bang. Because that thunderstorm that rolled through here around 9:30 on Wednesday night, the 4th of July, kind of did the trick there, and things got better. Man, yesterday was so beautiful.
Wasn't it? That I think yesterday was like my favorite day so far this summer.
Yeah, I also had some time on Friday to do some grilling, fresh lake trout.
Ooh,
on the grill.
Ooh, mm-hmm. That sounds yummy.
Mm-hmm, it was.
Did you plank it?
No, I didn't. It had the skin was on, and just got that grill good and hot, put it right on the grill.
Ooh.
20 minutes, season to taste, and it was delicious.
Oh, that sounds great. What'd you have with it?
Potatoes and some roasted corn.
Ooh. Yeah, I noticed that.
And a Caesar salad for a little...
A little health there? A little green?
That was the prefix meal, as you might say.
Wow, very nice.
It was very good.
Very nice. We had a Polish buffet for the 4th of July.
Oh, that's right. You were telling me about that.
I mean, and I think we have actually enough food that we will be eating Polish food on Super Bowl Sunday. Which, hey, it never goes bad, okay? Stuff cabbage rolls from here out.
They'll keep.
I will tell you. Yeah.
They'll keep.
Oh, yes. But, yeah, we had a nice little... birthday/holiday celebration. So it was very nice with the friends and neighbors and family. All great. And but it was humid. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
The 4th. It reminded me of my days going to school down in Edwardsville and that St. Louis kind of swampy atmosphere.
Oh, it doesn't get down that bad, does it?
Oh, man. That was a place.
I'm being facetious.
Well, the rule basically was if you wanted to do anything outside, you should do it by 9 in the morning.
Oh, you're right.
I mean, it was
Right.
And,
yeah, I've been down there when it's utterly stifling.
And going to some of those Cubs Cardinal games at the old Busch Stadium where the heat would radiate off the AstroTurf. I mean, I think it got over 110 degrees regularly on that AstroTurf that they had down there back in the day. And then you had the old Busch Stadium, which was basically one of those old circle, all multi-purpose stadiums.
Yep, cookie cutter.
Yep. And I always said it was always easy to clean it because at night after everybody left, they could just put the flush handle down on it.
It was 10,000 feet away from the field in there trying to watch the game.
But, I mean, it was almost like there would be days where it's like a fog. The humidity is really that thick. But, gosh, it's so beautiful out. Beautiful out this morning, too. And nice to see a nice sunny day. A little hot on Monday, I see.
90 again. Nothing like we had last week, the week before, where we had heat indices of 100 or more. Nothing like that in the offing. But a little hotter, a little more humid, and probably at or a little bit above normal for what we should have this year.
Yeah, but then the rest of the week looks gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
80s and everything like that.
Yep. And, I don't know if it's getting, if it's me getting older or not, but is it true that these summers are getting shorter and shorter? In other words, before you know it, it's all over.
Yeah.
So that means you have to take advantage of this as much as possible.
Oh, absolutely. Because we'll be talking about the newsroom Zamboni before too long.
Yes, sure. We will. Yes, we will. The slip and slide got lost in the transfer from Tribune Tower.
No.
Over here. Well, no. I'll have to find it.
Trust me, we're on the case on it. We are on the case.
Andy, any thoughts on that?
I haven't seen it, and did not touch it.
Well, all right. Well, speaking of hot, though.
Yes.
How about those Cubs yesterday?
Yeah, not a bad little comeback. 5 runs. And I was surprised to read that this is the largest comeback, the largest deficit they've had this year to come back for a win.
Right, because they've had a lot of comeback victories.
Seems like they have like 55 of them.
Yeah. But what is it about the Reds? I just don't get it.
I think it's the Jim Riggleman theory, the former manager of the Cubs.
Right.
You know, he might have a little something on them.
Yeah.
I have no idea. It's, you know, one of those, every year it seems like one team has another team's number, whether
right.
it be a last place team against a first place team or two middle of the road kind of teams. It's just, you know, hey, the White Sox had beat the Brewers 2 out of 3. They beat the Red Sox 2 out of 3. So, I mean, any team really has a chance to beat another, I hate to say any given day, but that's
right.
pretty much how
right.
it goes.
But speaking of comebacks, did you see the Washington comeback? I forget who they were playing. It was late last week. They were down 9-0,
mm-hmm.
and they came back to win it.
Yeah, that's a pretty talented team that
wow.
they've got there in Washington. If they can just put it all together.
They're only playing like 500.
Yeah, they haven't been able to really put things together with their starting pitching. Steven Strasburg's been out for a while. They had an epic performance from Mark Reynolds last night, which I'm going to bring up in the 8 o'clock sportscast
okay.
here. But he had 10 RBIs yesterday.
Jeez.
In one game.
10 RBIs.
That's a good week for some.
That's a good month.
It
could be a season for some
month
people.
For a few guys. Yeah. So, I mean, they have a pretty decent ball club, but again, they've struggled pitching and they've struggled in their bullpen.
Yep. And that, I saw word of some kind of a Bowles trade.
Yeah, it's still kind of iffy as to really what's going on here, but it's a reported 3-team deal where the Bulls, the Magic, and the Hornets got together, and the Bulls end up sending Jerry and Grant to Orlando, and they get a guard by the name of Julian Stone, who is kind of their type of player right now because he has an expiring contract and he's not guaranteed, so they can actually waive him and, you know, save some money under the cap with Jerry and Grant.
Okay.
So that might be what they were looking for. I'm not sure if it's
more of a
procedural kind of thing.
Right, a technical deal rather than an actual athletic deal.
Clear a spot for one of the draft choices, and there's some guys that are playing pretty well in the summer league. Dante Ingram, by the way, the Loyola kid, played last night and started last night for the Bulls summer league team in Las Vegas. Scored 5 points. Good to see.
I was surprised. I'm not a real big NBA fan,
mm-hmm.
but I've just been surprised to see all the attention that the summer league is getting.
It has grown immensely because it used to be played in high school gyms, and you know, you could go to a carpeted hotel ballroom and maybe catch a game in the summer league. And now with NBA TV and just the attention being played, and it's in some great spots. I mean, you know, Las Vegas. Who doesn't want to be in Las Vegas for a while? And you know, LA also gets a couple of games. So,
well, Las Vegas in the summer.
Yeah, but still, you're inside. I mean, still Las Vegas, you know.
And there are no clocks.
Correct. Lots of oxygen.
That might be the only clock in Vegas, maybe on the scoreboard.
Yeah,
for
it
the
counts
summer
down.
League.
So, I mean, it's like you better hurry up and play that hand, or you're in trouble.
Oh man, no, but all good fun. I mean, because
yeah.
I know for the Olympics,
mm-hmm.
it's the summer Olympic sport, basketball,
right.
but it still seems kind of odd, you know, just not to have the season going on.
Yeah.
It's a winter sport.
You know, and it's cool now, too, because I don't think it's caught on as much as Major League Baseball's minor league system. I mean, obviously, White Sox fans are paying a lot of attention to what's going on in the minors.
Sure.
Cubs fans were doing that a few years ago. You know, you draft guys and you try to follow them and see where they're going. You know, now with the NBA G League, which is that sort of quote-unquote minor league system, you know, the Windy City Bulls are with the Chicago Bulls. You kind of know more about these guys, and you want to see maybe what they can do. Maybe, you know, with a team like the Bulls in rebuild mode.
Sure, where you look for the future.
Yeah, you find somebody, you know, find a diamond in the rough. You see a guy that, you know, who knows, could be Dante Ingram.
You know?
Why not, right?
Exactly. I was just going to say, why not? Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Cassara is back to field your calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. And we're on Twitter at @SymbolSundaySpin. And yes, Engineer Bob is looking for the WGN Newsroom slip and slide. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. We're following that issue of the boys soccer team in Thailand and the cave rescue. We've got some breaking news on that. Off to the newsroom. Here's Dave.
Rick, we have word from ABC News that they have confirmed that two of the boys have been rescued. Two of the boys, the first two to come out of this cave, were rescued some time ago, within the last hour or so. The total time for this rescue mission, if all continues to go well, will be 2 to 4 days. To give you an idea as to how tedious and tricky this was an 8-hour process to get these first two out of there. So it's going to take a long, long time for this to do and do correctly. There is no word on their condition yet, but again, ABC News saying two of the 12 boys have been rescued from the cave in Thailand. We will be following this story all morning. Rick?
Yes, and Dave, this morning I was seeing some of the reporting on this, and they said that the boys, and as well as with the doctor, were going to decide which of them would be the first ones out. And so it was a question of whether the healthier ones, because of just the sheer stress and trauma of this, if healthier ones come out first or ones that might be weaker and more in need of medical attention.
Right. That's a tough decision to make. Do you want to take the healthy ones first, or do you want to take the weaker ones, and will they be able to withstand the stress to get out of there? So there's all kinds of very, very tough decisions to be made. Keep in mind, they're 2,000 to 4,000 feet underground. So there's so many factors here that play into this.
And the rain is.
There's more rain on the way, but it is holding off for now.
Well, that's good news, and that's good news so far. Dave will be jumping in with any more breaking news on that. Plus, he'll have full details at our newscast at 7:30. Time to kick off our weekly spin through national politics, and quite a week for the Trump administration. Embattled EPA Director Scott Pruitt, under 14 separate investigations, was forced to resign his post after even Donald Trump found his activities to be a distraction. But the president was angry, and in a campaign speech in Montana, he railed against a dying John McCain, an infirm George H.W. Bush, Senator Elizabeth Warren, the hashtag MeToo movement, and the media. Then he went to his New Jersey golf course. All of this comes against the backdrop of his scheduled White House address Monday night, in which the president is expected to name his replacement for Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. The issue is already playing out nationally. In Maine, an abortion rights group is running ads targeting Republican Senator Susan Collins.
If Donald Trump has his way, the next Supreme Court pick will turn the court against a woman's constitutional right to safe legal abortion. Trump said he'll only pick judges who'd overturn Roe and outlaw abortion.
There has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
Senator Susan Collins could be the deciding vote on Trump's pick for justice. She claims to support a woman's right to have an abortion, so why won't she rule out voting for Trump's anti-choice picks? Call Senator Collins and tell her to keep her word. Oppose Trump's list of extreme nominees.
Now, you have that group, and then you have Collins herself, who is on MSNBC, where she said she won't vote for someone vowing to overturn Roe versus Wade, but she says her decision is much more complicated than just that issue.
How can you ask me to take a position on a nominee whose identity I don't yet know? That I'm amazed that people on both sides of the aisle have already committed to voting either for or against a nominee whose identity they do not know. And that's what you're asking me to do. There may be an individual.
It's about the issue that it is about the person.
There may be
your belief that it's precedent, and that law should...
I've already told you that the person demonstrates hostility towards Roe v. Wade and doesn't consider it to be settled law and precedent that I don't see how I could vote to that for that person. But what you're not allowing for is there could be a person who is very strongly for Roe v. Wade, but lacks the qualification, the experience, the integrity, has ethical issues in the background. The FBI report turned up some troubling issues. I'm not going to vote for that person.
Meanwhile, we have the trade war heating up between the U.S. and China, tariffs imposed on exports in both countries on Friday, and some Republicans fear that any gains that they may have made through their tax cuts with consumers may lose out over the higher costs of imports for Americans. Here's Texas Republican Representative Jeb Hensarling on CNN.
Most people in America are enjoying the best economy they've ever had in their lifetimes, and I give the president great credit for that, for the tax cut and Jobs Act, for recalibrating regulation. And so this economy, in some respects, is President Trump's economy. But the economy he brought us, he can also take away if this trade war gets out of hand. And so that is a great concern that I have. Number one, what I'd like to hear from this administration is, what is the end game? Because if it's simply to get rid of the trade deficit, we could get rid of the trade deficit tomorrow if we outlawed trade, but our GDP would also be headed south, as would disposable family income. If the president's goal, like he announced at the G7, was to bring down tariffs, that's good. I hope his strategy proves to be brilliant, but right now it seems like we are in for a rocky ride, and we have to realize that most of our imports are actually B2B, business to business, and we use different component parts for Americans to produce products for Americans built by Americans, and I'm afraid a lot of them could be caught up in a trade war. Is not good for anybody. The question is, who's going to lose more?
Now, there also have been calls lately among some leading Democrats to eliminate ICE amid the heated debate over immigration. But last Sunday on CNN, Illinois Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth said that getting rid of the Homeland Security's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Unit, she doesn't think it'll really would change anything.
I just think that if you abolish ICE as it is, as an executive agency, it reflects the policies of the White House, of the president. You abolish ICE now, you still have the same president with the same failed policies. Whatever you replace it with is just going to still reflect what this president wants to do.
So no, you don't support abolishing ICE?
I think there's a lot of other things we can do before we get to that point.
That's U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Dave, I'm just getting word from our colleagues at WGN-TV that now three members of that Thai soccer team, have been rescued out of the cave. That's according to WGN Television and CNN reporting on that. So I know you'll have regular updates as the story continues to develop this morning.
Yes, we are also looking at information here that the rescue effort is ongoing. We may see some more boys emerging soon, so we will definitely keep you posted on this.
Thanks for keeping an eye on that. We're back here on the Sunday Spin with breaking news going on, but there's all kinds of news, as always, in the world of politics. And I played a cut from Tammy Duckworth, who was on Jake Tapper's show last week. She was talking about immigration issues there, but she was also asked the question of whether the Democratic Party may be moving too far to the left after Democratic voters in New York embraced a 28-year-old Latina Democratic socialist over a 10-year veteran congressional incumbent. Here's what Tammy Duckworth had to say.
You can't win the White House without the Midwest, and I don't think that you can go too far to the left and still win the Midwest. Coming from a Midwestern state, I think you need to be able to talk to the industrial Midwest. You need to listen to the people there and in order to win an election nationwide.
And that's Tammy Duckworth speaking with Jake Tapper last Sunday. Joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio, is Pat Brady. Pat's the former head of the state Republican Party. He's also the founder of Next Generation Strategies. Pat, thanks so much for joining me.
It's great to be here. Beautiful morning, huh?
Isn't it great to wake up to this beautiful skyline here?
You know, the thing is, I noticed on the walk cut across the loop, the economy must be doing well because the beer bottles that were left on the bridges are all pretty high in beer.
Really?
Yeah,
well,
no cheap stuff.
Well,
so things are good.
And that's good for sales taxes, too. Well, thanks again for getting up with me. And I want to ask you about what Tammy Duckworth said, because, you know, as much as people are looking at the Republicans, and there are issues there, but this continued kind of festering divide within the Democratic Party, that doesn't help them.
No, and we've been talking about this for a long time. It's just more acute with the Republicans because we have the presidency and the president who's very visible. We've had a lot of these debates publicly as Republicans. I mean, Democrats have been struggling with this for a while, but I agree with Senator Duckworth that you can't go too far to the left and win in the Midwest. I do think, though, that New York win for that young woman who was very far to the left, it's basically socialist.
She is a Democratic Socialist Party member.
I think that's more of an outlier. And if you look at the races, the 15 or 16 races that are really going to make or break who takes over the House, those are more centrist Democrats than she might be. So I agree completely that they're getting yanked to the left. Like the Republicans, to a certain respect, are getting yanked to the right. But the difference is President Trump has been able to appeal to those Midwest more conservative Democrats and Republicans, and that's what got him elected.
Well, and two, when you look at things like, I mean, as much as you talk about Tammy Duckworth in the Midwest, I mean, still the Democratic primary in the state was very close.
Very close, and the energy in that our Democratic governor primary, assume you're talking about.
I'm talking about the Democratic presidential primary.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders was very close.
Very close, and if you saw the in the governor primary, even though J.B. Pritzker won by a healthy margin, there was a lot of energy with a guy like Dan Biss, who won some of those downstate counties that are traditionally more conservative Democrats, and even the messages of Kennedy and Biss were much more progressive than J.B. Pritzker's was. So there's a lot. That's where the energy in the party is, and certainly here in Illinois.
And so it's a matter of how Democrats try to find their unity, Republicans struggling to find their unity in this state.
Yeah, I think in the last couple months, the governor's had a good 6 or 7 weeks. I think you're seeing after a pretty messy primary that a lot of the people that were at odds with each other have come together. And the governor has had a good 5 or 6 weeks. We got a budget. We got the GNS decision, school funding reform bill now actually in place. So I think he's had a good 5 or 6 weeks, and a lot of people are more optimistic than they might have been in March about what might happen in November.
Although there have been missteps along the way.
Sure.
I mean,
there always is.
the comments about Champaign-Urbana, for example.
Yeah, that was on a Row podcast, and I listened to it with John Cass last week. And if you actually listen to what he's saying, I grew up downstate.
Right.
And I love it. I know it very, very well. And what he was saying was actually there is some truth to it. Not that Champaign, Bloomington, and downstate communities aren't great places to be. And I get the political environment where something like he says gets blown up. But there are a lot of reasons why people might want to live up here versus down in Champaign just because of the, for a lot of reasons. But that doesn't mean that Champaign's not a great place to live. And that was a kind of an unfortunate moment. And Governor Ronner went down and apologized, and hopefully that people aren't upset about it.
I do have to admit, I did like Representative Carol Ammon's picture tweet of the governor on the bus saying, "I remember my first bus ride." It was
Well, you know, I've yet to see J.B. Pritzker on any public transport. Maybe his first jet ride, but private jet ride.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this budding race, okay? I mean, we've got it's toilets and taxes. And is that just going to be the game from here on to November?
Maybe, but I'd rather be someone that's talking about tax reform and reduction than talking about rigging your property taxes on your second Astor Street mansion. And I think what's happened in the last 6 or 7 weeks, and believe me, on primary night when I watched the speeches, I thought, man, we've got an uphill climb as Republicans. But governor's had a good 5, 6 weeks talking taxes, corruption, jobs, and a lot of Democrats even are wondering, why is J.B. Pritzker even running? I don't know what his message is. And the message right now is he rigged his ripped toilets out of his second Astor Street mansion so he could skirt on $250,000 in taxes. And that's a bad message, particularly downstate.
Well, and I mean, I think what's curious here is, and of course, as we know in politics, everything old is new again.
Right.
And
Like you and me.
Yeah, right. But you had to go there, didn't you? But we're, for example, this issue had been out there before.
Oh, I did the press conference.
And yes, you
it
were
was in
right.
May.
Yes. And, yeah. And, but I mean, so it
May, I'm sorry, of 17.
Right. So there was, I mean, there was ample opportunity to try to, for the Pritzker camp to kind of respond and or, you know, clean it up.
And that's my point. Even their response didn't clean it up because there is no response. What to me is before you run and you have that kind of money, you have Oppo people looking at everything you've ever done and make sure you've got that covered. And there was no response. In fact, even during the I think the best thing that happened to J.B. Pritzker on this issue is that Berrios lost because this issue would have been even more prominent. I still think this is the biggest issue in the campaign, our property taxes. People are just fed up. And now we have the Democratic nominee who rigged his property taxes to avoid it. Not just that, he's a multi-billionaire, and the rest of us are picking up the tab. That's a pretty potent issue. Back to your point, is this going to be about taxes and toilets? It may well be, and that toilet issue might sink you.
But when the governor talks about property taxes, he also has delivered kind of a mixed message on this. Because, I mean, it's very plain, you know, we should freeze them, even try to cut them.
Right.
But then when it comes to actual procedural things, he's advocated positions that ostensibly would add to property tax burden, like shifting pension costs over to local school districts. You know, trying, and obviously, you know, looking at a way to reduce state taxes.
Right.
But it's not going to change the universe, and it's going to fall, you're going to pay for it out of one pocket or the other.
Yeah, but I think the overall message is we need more taxpayers, not more taxes. And however, and there are all kinds of proposals out there, and it all ties to the big pension debt, which is the elephant in the room. But at least Governor Rauner is speaking of reforms and changes, whereas J.B. Pritzker, I haven't really heard him say anything other than a progressive income tax, which requires us to change the Constitution. And to me, and a lot of people, that's a tax increase, and he hasn't even given the details on that. So that, I guess that's my point. I still don't know, and I think a lot of people, even Democrats, are wondering, why are you even running? You may have a lot of issues with Governor Rauner on his agenda or how he's tried to implement it, but at least he has an agenda. So far, J.B. Pritzker, his only agenda is, I'm going to protect our values. I'm not sure exactly what that means.
Well, I mean, and obviously there is the issue of, you know, the Donald Trump in this whole contest.
But interestingly, and I'm looking at this realistically, that this it's always an uphill climb for us to win in this state, but we can do it if we're unified. But Donald Trump now is about 48% nationally, where he was in the low 40s, maybe high 30s, and after the March primary. And he's kind of a double-edged sword in this state. He actually helps Republicans sitting south of I-80, maybe south of I-74. He's pretty popular down there. He's not popular up here, but he's popular, I mean, north of I-80 in Chicago and the six big counties, but he's pretty popular downstate.
Yeah, but are there enough votes?
Well, again, it all depends on who turns out, as it always does. And the energy, is, as we said earlier, to me in the Democratic Party is with the progressives. And I'm not sure if they're fired up about the insider billionaire, as they might have been about a Dan Biss or a Chris Kennedy.
We're speaking to Pat Brady, former head of the state Republican Party and founder of Next Generation Strategies. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking the Chicago River on Upper Wacker Drive. And joining me here in studio is Pat Brady, founder of Next Generation Strategies. We're talking about the governor's race a little bit. I'm curious about one issue, and I noticed that the governor has put this on his list of accomplishments, is the fact that in the recently passed and approved budget was $53 million in capital spending to deal with the Quincy Veterans Home. And to me, that whole issue of Quincy, I think, it represents a significant challenge for the governor.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. And there were so many competing interests down there. And the issue, unfortunately, on both sides got really politicized. And we're talking about veterans and the people that we should take care of the most and make sure that they're healthy and happy. But yeah, that could be, they could make an issue of that. But I do think even at one point, Senator Durbin went down there early on and said, hey, the governor's pretty much doing everything he can. But I do. There might be some vulnerability there. But he put Mike Hoffman down there to make sure a veteran to make sure the job's done right. And I think there are other issues that are going to be more important. But I'm sure that issue will come up in the campaign.
But to me, it seems like a touchstone-type political issue.
I think Democrats have tried to make it that, but I think if you talk to a lot of people, they're not as tuned into it as there might be the people that are reading the blogs every day.
True. But then there's always the advertising to come. And
yeah, but there's a risk, in, I think, for the Democrats in politicizing that issue. That's you could, I think that could really backfire on you if you go too far with it. There are other issues I think people are more concerned with, even though that's a huge issue and a terrible thing for the veterans. But I think there are a lot of things that the governor did that if they do make an issue of it, he can talk about that I think are going to shed a lot of light on it that people don't really know right now. What? I think he played it right, is just get down there and take care of it. And I think he has. And Mike Hoffman's one of the finest people that the governor's had in his administration. I think that money being there will all be taken care of. Remember in Quincy, they didn't want that removed. They were talking about pulling it out, and the people that lived down there didn't want to pull it out.
Understood, but you're also talking about 3 years of, I mean, from the initial outbreak to money being done to fix it. You're talking about 2015,
Oh, we didn't have a budget for 2 years, so...
Yeah, okay, but still, I mean...
Listen, could they make an issue of it? Yeah, but I think there's some danger in doing that, and I think more important to me is that the issue has been taken care of, and hopefully we won't see any more of that again, just for the veterans' sake.
Sam McCann, on the ballot, does he present a serious risk to the governor?
You know, and you know this as well as anybody, I have never seen anybody accurately predict the impact of a third-party candidate. And we've seen this in election after election after election. Now, the conventional wisdom is that's going to be, he's going to be the conservative party. That's going to take away from Governor Rauner. But I could see, having grown up downstate, very familiar with that part of the state, there are a lot of conservative Democrats that aren't going to be thrilled with insider J.B. Pritzker, who are as conservative as some Republicans who might say, hey, this is a labor guy, much more so than J.B.'s ever
been. Well, that's what I mean. He presents this kind of unique...
Yeah.
Animal, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, he could draw more from JB than he would from Governor Rauner.
I mean, pro-labor social conservative.
Absolutely.
That's broader than just, I think, what we saw in the Republican primary from Jeannie Ives.
Exactly. That's my point. We don't know what's... I'm sorry, to answer your question, I don't think anybody really knows what impact it's going to have. But, you know, with Sam McCann, not a household name.
Well, and that's the thing, is what kind of juice is going to be behind him, you know?
I can't see who would get behind him. I mean, money-wise?
Yes.
I don't think there's going to be a lot of money behind him.
I mean,
think
we've seen a little bit from the operating engineers at 150, right. I think.
Okay, so he's a labor guy, so that's not going to help him with the downstate Republicans necessarily. It helps him with downstate Democrats. But I don't think on the Republican side, some of the traditional money sources that might go outside the Governor Rauner are going to get involved with that. And there aren't that many there, so I'm not sure who's going to fund it. But you can't just, we're pretty close to the election day to build name ID, which he has none of, really.
I want to switch gears a little bit. You were a former federal prosecutor. We've got the big announcement coming up from the president tomorrow night, picking the replacement for Anthony Kennedy. We were talking off the air. It's, guess what? It's going to be conservative, right?
Yeah, I hope it's a conservative, more like a Gorsuch that's just strictly interpreting the Constitution and apply the Constitution. But it will be a conservative. And the Democrats, this is one of those things, if you're irritated with the Democratic Party for a lot of reasons, you'd be really irritated with this because the change in the rules in the Senate to allow 51 votes to the Supreme Court nominee to get through and the fact that you lost the presidency in the Senate and the House, or the Senate most importantly, we're going to have another conservative justice, however that fits in the conservative bandwidth, and we're going to have a conservative court for a long, long time.
Well, and it's not just even at the Supreme Court level. We're also looking, you know, down the list, too.
Oh, it goes down to the district.
But as far as how this has, you know, an impact for several years in the future.
Remember, President Obama said famously, elections have consequences. What happens when you win, and this is, but it will be conservative. The difference, I think, a little bit in this selection process is there are actually farm players identifiable by the conservative groups that sign up for certain candidates, that these people are historically very...
Well, you have the Federalist Society.
Right, which we didn't really have. You have people that you've watched for more than a couple of years, watch their voting records and see that you don't tend not to get as many surprises like a Souter or some of those people that kind of come off the reservation, even back to the Eisenhower days where they come off the reservation a little bit. So it'll be a conservative. I hope it's someone that can get through without a big battle that will hurt the party and the country.
And we have a Chicago Seventh Circuit judge who's on the list.
Yeah, Judge Justice Barrett. Young, would be on the court for a long, long time, just barely on the Court of Appeals, so she doesn't have a long history of deciding cases. I'm not sure if she's the front runner anymore.
Well, and of course, her nomination, there was the great controversy that was evoked. I believe it was Dianne Feinstein that raised issues about her religious beliefs.
That's a no-no in a country that fought a revolution so you could believe how you like. So that back, and I like Dianne Feinstein. I think she's one of the smartest people in the Senate, but that backfired on her. And if they bring that argument up again, I think it will backfire. That will not play well with any sector, I don't think, of this country, maybe a small sector of the progressive wing, to attack somebody's religious beliefs.
Democrats obviously want to put up a fight, but it doesn't work
any
numbers.
They don't have any ammo. Right. You're right.
You don't know who it is.
Yeah.
I mean, even as Susan Collins said, even though she's positioned herself that, she wants somebody that's going to uphold Roe, but they don't have the numbers. And then you start looking at some of those Democratic senators in traditionally
Manchin
red states.
Yeah.
It seems like there's no way really for them to stop this.
Unless something really blows up, but you got to give President Trump credit. He's pretty savvy with these kind of things, and they actually work out pretty well for him. So the people that I've seen on the list, I think, are people that should pass. But it's been interesting to watch how the Democrats have framed this, as this is all about Roe v. Wade, and that's going to be the litmus test for this candidate. And the Republicans, their position has been, we're going to support somebody that supports the Latin term of stare decisis, means respect for precedent. And I think if you give that answer, that I respect the precedent of the court, that'll get you over that hump as the nominee.
Although, as we just saw with the Janus decision, that meant nothing. 41 years old.
Yep.
And it was, I mean, obviously the majority ruling was that, you know, that was an outdated.
Right. It was facts on the ground. Honestly, if you read that, as I know you have, if that weren't an Illinois case, I'm not sure if it goes that way, the way that the court decided it, because they did cite the facts on the ground are just different, though. There's not so much diversity in the unions. It's pretty much controlled by Warner, you know, very strong unions.
And also even to the point of, you know, noting Illinois' financial crisis.
Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah.
It's like the court talks about it in the decision. But listen, on the other side,
I was going to say, Illinois was not exactly, I've said this to friends, I said Illinois was not exactly the poster child to bring this to the court.
No, but the facts on the ground might have made a difference in the court's decision. But anyway, we talked about this on the Cochran. It was a First Amendment analysis,
right.
and then applying the First Amendment analysis to the law here that got it where it is. But that is I'd like to talk to you about this too. I think long run, that's a big win for Governor Rauner. Now we talked Thursday, that might be a political mixed bag.
Yeah, I mean, is this something that is on the conservative, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, seriously, I don't know that I have that appreciation of it as far as a major checklist kind of thing for conservatives.
Well, look at who stood on the Supreme Court's steps the day of the decision. It was Governor Rauner and John Tillman from the Illinois Policy Institute.
Yeah, a couple.
Getting along during the primary, and that's part of the unification, or I think unifying the Republican Party behind Governor Rauner. I think Janus went a long way to doing that. In addition to, the reality is when we talked on Thursday, I had kind of a different view of this, but when I saw the editorial boards across the state come out and say, labor union leaders, you did this to yourself. Had you played ball at all, we might not have had a Janus decision, but your unwillingness to bend on anything, I think, led to this lawsuit being filed and the decision that came down. And Governor Rauner's worked out deals with some 22 unions. AFSCME is the only one that won't deal. And I think that's the point of the editorials. I think people now understand that maybe this labor union was a little out of control in its demands, not necessarily representing the interests of its membership, but for its own survival. And they weren't willing to, you know, these are tax dollars that pay these employees, and then maybe they went a little too far in what they were trying to do, and that's what happened.
Well, we're going to speak in the next hour to Robert Bruno from the University of Illinois and a labor expert there, and talk to kind of dive into the issue and look at what the future may be.
What do you think? We talked quickly about this Thursday. How's the politics shake out, you think?
How does the politics of it shake out?
Yeah.
I do think in some cases there is an energizing effect.
For the Democrats.
For Democrats, yeah. On that. But overall, who knows where it falls into the checklist. But if the fact that labor being such a major part of the Democratic constituency, I think there's more of a necessarily impact there than conservatives versus going siding with Ron or on it. That's just how I see it.
Never boring here, is it?
There's always something, right? Pat Brady, founder of Next Generation Strategies, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good to see you guys. Thanks.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Former presidential contender Mitt Romney, now seeking a Republican Senate bid in Utah. He was on MSNBC the other day, and he told Cassie Hunt that he thinks the Rush investigation is appropriate and should continue.
I think it's a totally appropriate evaluation by our government. Russia's clearly trying to become involved in the electoral process here and distort that process. We need to find out how and where, punish the people who have potentially been involved in that kind of disruption. And I'd like to see the Mueller investigation completed, take it to its conclusion. I doubt you're going to see something which implicates the president. I think that's very unlikely based on kind of the soundings that have been heard so far. But I do think we need to understand where Russia has been trying to play and to make sure they can do so in the future.
That's Mitt Romney. Joining me now on the phone is Robert Bruno, professor and director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Bob, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
We talked about this last week on the show about the Janus v. AFSCME decision with the U.S. Supreme Court. But I wanted to talk to you because, you know, now we've all had a chance to kind of digest the ruling a bit. And while it's certainly wasn't unexpected, I guess the bottom line I'm wondering is where and Pat Brady and I even talked about, you know, what is the future for the public employees unions and the labor movement and Democrats as a result of this?
Yeah, well, there's a...
Don't mean to give you too much to...
lots to unpack there. I think, I mean, this was really a blow. This is a serious attack on the ability of public sector workers, and then frankly, workers in the private sector also, that they threat to their ability to collectively act on their interest, to act as something other than just isolated individuals, so that they can properly protect the work they do, protect the public that they serve. So this is a serious challenge, and I think it will lead to some reduction in the percentage of public sector workers who are unionized. So it's make no bones about it. It's a serious assault. But the public sector unions really have been prepping for this for some time because they expected this to happen a year before when there was a previous case before the Supreme Court. And there had been a series of other Supreme Court cases that had been decided by a similar majority, and they had been really nibbling away at public sector unions and the ability of workers in the public sector to negotiate contracts. So these unions, the teachers, AFSCME, really have, SEIU, have been planning and prepping for this. And they've been talking to the members. They've been out in the local. They have been taking a deep dive into that relationship with their members. And that should be very helpful in sustaining a certain level of membership and for maintaining a strong degree of solidarity. I think there are, you know, there's still lots of influence, quite frankly, that they have on the political process. There's still important players around a whole set of employment-related and labor-related issues, and I expect that they're going to, you know, continue to be active there, and there may actually be some you know, modifications to state collective bargaining laws that would be helpful. So, you know, this is a threat. There's just no way around it. This is harmful, but I think it may build a stronger activist base that will enable it to remain both important to workers in the workplace, to the public, who are recipients of public services, and also these folks will remain quite politically aware and conscious and active, may turn out to vote in higher numbers, may volunteer more time, may make more voluntary contributions to political action committees, because quite frankly, these unions now, in a way that they've never had to confront in the past, and the workers, quite frankly, now understand what's at risk and the value of having a collective bargaining unit. So we may see a level of activism unlike what we've actually seen in the past.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I was wondering is, and we touched on this with Pat Brady, the former state Republican chairman, afterwards, is, you know, I see in talking to people, at least in this very short term, as you mentioned, you know, now union members see what's at stake, and that if anything, there may be a mobilizing effect there that would help Democrats versus, you know, I'm not so sure that on the conservative checklist that that decision is something that necessarily helps Bruce Rauner or Republicans.
No. Actually, you know, I think that this, what this is going to do is it's really going to heighten and make just very evident the importance of having political leaders who support a working class, middle class agenda. That it's clear that it's important to cast those votes in ways that really represent the best of the options. And if and where those candidates certainly are Republican candidates, they will garner labor support, I think, particularly in state and local levels. And where they are Democratic candidates, well, they will also be supported. But that vote around where do you stand on workplace issues, where do you stand on collective bargaining, because now it isn't just some sort of transactional process. This is about you know, bigger issues. It's about our ability to provide good services, to build healthy communities, to reduce income inequality, all of those issues. And so the candidates that best represent that, frankly, I think are going to get strongly supported. And you know, if a percentage of those union voters were sitting on the sidelines, if they weren't turning out to vote, now I think you're going to see them reached. And what we know from lots of research is that when labor is able to make contact with their members, when they're able to really communicate to the broader community, they turn out numbers and they vote in ways that are consistent with that labor endorsed candidate. So in the particular, in this case of Illinois, I think this decision and the public sector union's ability to kind of ramp up and prepare for this is only going to increase their footprint on elections in November, from the governor's race through, you know, through the state races and down even into local levels. Now every vote is really going to count, and every vote is going to be clearly tied to some economic reality. And that will probably cut against some social issues and some more divisive cultural issues. It just kind of lays bare the kind of class issues that are at play. So, no, I don't think this really politically is going to help either Governor Rauner or Republican candidates who've been antagonistic to collective bargaining in the state.
We're speaking to Robert Bruno. He's a professor at the University of Illinois and director of the Labor Education Program. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back. The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with Robert Bruno, professor and director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois. Bob, we've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome as always.
Yes, good morning, Rick. Professor, I would just like for you to just make a distinction between public sector unions and the private sector unions. Just give you real quickly, remember when United Auto workers who just really negotiated these unaffordable wages out. As consumers, we were able to make a choice when the foreign cars start coming in the 80s. So I don't have a problem with private sector unions. They'll just get to a point where their product is unaffordable. In the public sector, and particularly in Illinois, these unions negotiate with elected officials, and they come up with these unaffordable benefit wages. But here's the problem. As a taxpayer, you have no choice. You can't do like in the automobile, so I'll go to another car. We are stuck with the taxes. I'm trying to have this discussion.
Okay, Ron, I'm going to have to hold you there. I'm going to have to hold you there. Okay. Bob?
Sure, yeah. So, look, I think there is a common misunderstanding about the way in which the bargaining process in the public sector has impacts on the need to generate revenue and how that compares in the private sector where you have this marketplace. And there certainly isn't enough time on the program to get into all of the distinctions. But let me make a couple of just quick points. In the public sector, the people who are working, people who are teachers, people who are working throughout government services, have a high percentage of these workers have college degrees, have master's degrees, and it's well above the percentage of workers in the private sector that have college degrees and master's degrees. So when you control for things like college education, and then you do comparison. What are people earning in the public sector? What are people earning in the private sector? What you find out is that people who work in the public sector actually have a wage penalty. They actually earn on average about, for teachers particularly, 10% less, 15% less, 18% less. Now there's some trade-off in terms of having a decent benefit package. Higher percentage of public sector workers have a health care plan and have retirement. But it simply isn't true that folks in the public sector are earning wages that are above in the private sector when you control for education, when you control for experience. And even the question of collective bargaining raising expenses in the public sector, and therefore there's this greater pressure on taxes. Quite frankly, when you take a good solid look and you do a comparison of places where collective bargaining exists as opposed to states where there isn't collective bargaining, and you control for all the appropriate factors, you don't see lower spending necessarily, and the impact and the tax rate that people are paying in a particular state really is driven by any number of different factors and variables, and it isn't really appropriate to lay that at the feet of the bargaining process. In fact, you could make the case that your taxes that you're paying, that yes, they're supporting people who are earning a middle-class wage, but those people are protecting trillions of dollars worth of assets within the community. They're educating children, they're protecting your waterways, they're protecting your streets, they're protecting your parks. These are the assets of the citizens of the state. So you make that kind of comparison and analysis, and you don't walk away saying, well, bargaining has led to this increase over and above what we otherwise would have spent. And it's also the case that people need to understand that some of the benefits that workers achieve in the public sector are actually set by They're set by legislation. And yes, of course, then unions are able to incrementally improve on those. But the idea is, of course, is that you do want to attract really capable, committed people to the public sector because you're serving citizens. You're not serving consumers who are buying a toothpaste. And one final thing, I would challenge the notion that the workers who work for Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors under UAW contracts were earning wages that were unreasonable or above what they were worth, and that was the reason why there was some serious retrenchment in the auto industry. Stories are far more complicated than simply blaming collective bargaining.
That's Robert Bruno, professor at the University of Illinois and director of the Labor Education Program. Bob, as always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
That was fun, Rick. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. Thanks, Dave, for all the work. And I know you'll keep us updated as news continues on the rescue of the boys, the soccer team from Thailand. Voting is over for the baseball all-star game, but give the Cubs some credit. On social media, they ran campaign-style ads to mark the fact that the game being played in Washington, D.C., they basically ran campaign ads. Here's one for Javi Baez.
Together, let's send someone to Washington, D.C. who stands up for those in need. A man like Javi Baez. He proudly helps those in need of highlight reel double plays. And he delivers for those in desperate need of home run balls. He's truly a man of the people. So send Javi and all your favorite Cubs to the All-Star Game in Washington, D.C. We want everybody in.
I am Javi Baez, and I approve this message.
That's great, isn't it? Just really, really good job. Well, joining me now on the phone is Gary McCarthy, former Chicago Police Superintendent, candidate for mayor of Chicago. Gary, thanks for joining me, and maybe you should have the Cubs do some of your campaign ads.
Yeah, you know what? That sounded pretty good, and I don't know whose accent is worse, mine or Javi's, but it certainly sounded professional.
Well, hey, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, my pleasure, Rick.
So we had yesterday the protests that shut down the Dan Ryan, led by Father Flager, over issues involving gun violence and lack of community investment. We actually saw on social media kind of a back and forth between Governor Bruce Rauner, who said, oh, well, there was a deal cut to leave some lanes open and still allow the protest, and Mayor Emanuel saying, you know, basically your dog whistling. What was your view of how this all turned out?
You know what, Rick? It's a really complicated situation, and whenever we have situations like this, I always harken back to the NATO summit in 2012 and the mass protests that we had and the way we handled it. We were able to control the crowd, keep them off highways, to my recollection.
Right.
There were times that we actually turned them from northbound on Michigan Avenue onto Wacker Drive and kind of kept them away from the Mag Mile. I'm not sure that we're in that same place that we were 6 years ago, though. World has changed dramatically, and I think we have to be much more tolerant when protests happen. As I've always said, I may not agree with the subject matter. You know, I don't like people burning American flags, but it's their First Amendment right, and I defend their right to protest. I may not always agree with what they're doing, but professionally that's how we handle it. You know, Leo Schmitz is a friend of mine. He's a former deputy chief in the CPD. He's a real professional. He knows what he's doing. And, you know, I trust Leo's judgment that was the call that needed to be made right there on the highway. Leo's the superintendent of the Illinois State Police now.
And they have jurisdiction.
You know, that's on the scene.
And
yeah, on the highway is the Illinois State Police. Off the highway is the Chicago PD.
So you're accepting Leo's decision as what was necessary at the scene.
Yeah, and Leo was on the scene and he made that call. So, I mean, I'm not going to question, you know, what he did because I wasn't there. I don't know how heated it was getting. You know, I don't know if they were prepared to make 200 arrests. Maybe not. But at the end of the day, Leo's a real professional, and I'm not going to question his judgment.
What, here we, you know, as we're still in these early formative stages of the mayoral race, what do you see as your path to victory?
You know, I think that Chicago is ready for a change. That's really evident from everybody I speak to. It's really evident from the polling that we've done. And our path to victory is just to stay where we are, to go with our strong suit, which obviously is crime. You know, the numbers in Chicago, let's get it straight. Let's do some truth-telling. There's about 330 more people killed over the last 3 years than the previous 3 years when I was superintendent. So this whole issue of crime being down, it's simply not true. And I don't think we should accept it. But there's three major issues in the city. It's the crime, it's the taxes and the economy, and it's the education system. They're all incredibly linked. You can't separate one from the other. We're losing our tax base because people are fleeing because of gun violence, because we're losing our tax base. We're closing mental health centers and schools on the south and the west side, which is causing more gun violence. So we need a holistic approach to handling all three of those things, plus recognizing the social economic divide in this country, and handling it, which we haven't done over the course of time. I think the mayor has run his course. His popularity is really poor. And I think at the end of the day, Chicago wants a change. One of my buddies in the financial world says that Chicago's ready for a Brexit. If we're happy with the way things are going, then just keep going. But I don't think anybody's happy with it. So the path of victory has to do with people ready for change here. I think that I'm a good change agent. I'm a manager. I've been at the top of city government in three major cities in this country. And I can do it.
When you talk about a holistic approach here, and including about issues of violence, what's needed to be done in the south and west sides of the city?
Well, first of all, we've got to stop the exodus from the city. We're one of the only major urban centers in the country that's lost population in the last 10 years. And to do that, first thing we have to do is make Chicago safe. That's the first thing. And we know how to do that. The blueprint is out there. Actually, just take a look at Wilmington, Delaware, where Bob Tracy, who came from New York with me, who was our chief of crime control strategies, is using the blueprint that we created, that we used here in Chicago, that got us to record lows in the murder rate. He's got a 50% reduction in the shooting rate over the last 2 years. So that blueprint exists. We got to first make it safe. But the other thing that I advocate for, and this has to do with the economy and the education system, is we need to bring back the trade schools. We need to put them on the south and the west side. And then we need to give small businesses tax credits to go to the south and the west side to create the market for jobs for those young men and women who are graduating from those trade schools with the skills that they need to move forward in life.
Is that something that should be done as part of the Chicago public schools, or is that part of like a city college type development, or how do you see that?
I see it as Chicago CPS. That's why I'm saying, if you just think about what I just talked about, those three issues are linked. The education system needs to be revamped so that we're focusing on giving people life skills to move ahead, and at the same time, stimulating small business growth by giving them tax breaks, not just these big corporations who are going to go downtown, which is what the mayor's focused on, and have some growth in the neighborhoods. And that will help prevent crime.
We're speaking to Gary McCarthy, former Chicago police superintendent and candidate for mayor of Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking the Chicago River. And joining me on the phone is mayoral candidate Gary McCarthy. Gary, you mentioned about the kind of the blueprint for dealing with crime that you had when you were police superintendent. Where did that go wayward?
I think that the political landscape of the city has created an environment where they've abandoned the plan. The plan is tried and true. New York has been doing it for almost 30 years at this point. And, you know, that's a city three times the size of Chicago that had 290 murders last year, where we had 770 in 2016. So the political winds in Chicago have completely reversed. Unfortunately, after my termination, there's a witch hunt conducted in the CPD. Some of the best and the brightest were forced to leave, and the department is being run politically now instead of performance-based.
How much of the crime issue in the city is really within the control of CPD? As I mean, as things like, you know, the number of illegal guns that are found on an hourly basis in the city, flowing in from Indiana and on parts unknown. I mean, how much of the gun violence problem is really something that CPD can deal with?
CPD can deal with it. I mean, Rick, look. But, you know, there's been some revisionist history that's been written, and let's just get something straight. The program that we brought to Chicago resulted in about a 40% reduction in crime over my tenure. We had back-to-back years of the lowest murder rates in the city since 1965. We had a 50% reduction in complaints against officers, and at the same time, we made less arrests. It wasn't about arresting everybody. It was about arresting the right people at the right place at the right time. And at the same time, there was almost a 70% reduction in police-related shootings while I was superintendent. So those are performance metrics that any police chief in the country would love to have. And at the end of the day, that is doable. But you have to have the political will to stand up and defend the department instead of throwing it under the bus, which has happened politically here. It's quite obvious.
Do you think that, what you're saying about throwing the department under the bus here, is that also kind of just a national attitude that you see on behalf of, you know, some politicians?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a national issue. But again, I'm going to point at New York. New York had one of the worst incidents in policing in the last 20 years, which was the quote-unquote chokehold death of Eric Garner. And even Mayor de Blasio, who I think everybody knows leans a little bit further left than most people, did not fire Bill Bratton. They did not abandon the plan in reverse course, which is what we've done here in Chicago. We've handcuffed the police while emboldening criminals. And that's a recipe for disaster. There's no two ways about it. So it's a national issue, but at the same time, if you have the moxie to stick to the plan and do the right thing, look, if a police officer violates the law, they need to be prosecuted, just like anybody else. And if they violate policy, they need to be disciplined. But that doesn't mean that you abandon everything and throw it out the window. And that's what we've done here.
I want to ask you about city finances, too. I mean, obviously, the issues of burgeoning debt, pension debt, the fact that we've had seen our taxes being increased to try to cope with those kind of debts. How do we get out of that spiral?
Well, first of all, you know, in the last election, I was kind of aghast when I heard Chuy Garcia talk about the fact that when he gets to City Hall on day one, he'll be able to tell you what his plan was, because he didn't know where the money went. And while I certainly will never say that, what I can say is this. Look at some of the projects that we're talking about right now, and I think that we're wasting money. We've got $60 million spent on a flyover over by Navy Pier. That was supposed to cost $30 million. And I'm sorry, but instead of a bike path, I'd be looking at putting social services on the south and the west side or opening a school. Instead of spending potentially $95 million, which we all know will be $180 million by the time this new police academy is created, I would spend that money somewhere else. So the question is, where is the money being spent? It's being stripped from some places. Where is the TIF funding going? Because the education tax money is supposed to be in there. Is it going to education? So We need to set budgets. We need to stick to those budgets and not just blow through them. And we have to have a plan. Has anybody ever heard a financial plan out of City Hall? I haven't heard one. So if you don't have a plan, it's just writing checks and losing money. We're borrowing to pay our debt. That's insanity. That's like paying your MasterCard with your Visa. None of this stuff makes sense, and it can be fixed.
So we just have the mayor announcing this capital improvement plan for new education, a new school on the west side. Here again, that's capital funding. It's debt funding.
Exactly right. Exactly right. The other thing that we've done is we now borrow money to pay settlements. They're not within our budget. And I mean, we're just digging deeper and deeper holes for ourselves. It's not going to be easy, but there has to be fiscal responsibility. And I don't see that happening right now. Money's being spent politically. Let's put it that way. It's not being spent functionally.
Well, along with this issue of education, what's your view about supporters who say that the city should have an elected board of education?
I kind of want to split the baby on that one. If I'm accountable for the education system, just like I was accountable for the behavior of CPD officers, but I wasn't in charge of the discipline system, you know, accountability without authority is failure. And that's what I had with CPD. It's going to be the same thing with the schools. But what I am willing to say is let's split the baby. Let's have a partially elected school board so that it's not, at least there's community input into what's happening rather than just me having to make the decisions.
So have it split both ways with some neighborhood input kind of thing as well as mayoral control?
Exactly. Exactly. Partially elected school board so that the community has some input into what's going on. But by the same token, I need some say in what's happening because I'm going to be accountable for it.
All right, Gary, your website for the campaign?
Gary for Mayor, and that's with two R's. GaryForMayor.com. Pretty simple. It's a pretty functional website that we have right now. You can go on there. You can take a look at our policies. We're going to be releasing our crime policy next week. So there'll be a little bit of buzz about that. I think that we have a pretty good plan. There's a number of things that we kind of have to call out to create a safe city. And it starts with stopping the political micromanagement of CPD, letting the professionals run the department and hold them accountable for getting it done and run City Hall like a business, not a political machine.
That's Gary McCarthy, former Chicago Police Superintendent and candidate for mayor of the city. Gary, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Rick.